ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
On Boxing Day, I think we had 150 mils in about 8 hours. I've had a lot of my tracks just had the fines taken off them, so they'll have to be resurfaced. And rough estimate have been quoted around the $40,000 to $50,000 mark.
Calls to overhaul the country's disaster recovery funding arrangements, with farmers suffering serious damage in summer storms and extreme weather still waiting to access support, and catching fish and fighting crime. How a back injury led a Queensland man to the ocean, and how he's hoping to reel in up to 300 at-risk teens.
I was recovering from a serious back injury, and I take myself fishing every day, and then just had a moment one day where I realised how lucky I was, how fishing essentially pulled me out of a pretty bad place in my life at that time. You see that smile on a kid's face when they catch a fish. It's priceless for me, it's priceless for the parents watching, it's priceless for that kid.
I'm Michelle Stanley and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Ngarluma Country, Karratha. Forking out repairs and maintenance is a standard part of life as a farmer, but when the bill comes for repairs following a natural disaster, the fallout can be devastating. It's a situation some farmers in Victoria are currently grappling with after their properties were hit by flooding late last year. There are funds available for disaster relief, but gaps in the system mean some farmers aren't eligible for financial support, simply because the extreme weather event isn't recognised as a disaster. From regional Victoria, reporter Fiona Broome has this story.
It's been a tough summer for farmers across Victoria. Fires, floods and storms have swept across the state. Some of these disasters attracted recovery funding within a couple of days. Others are yet to be declared disasters. Damien Stock runs a small beef cattle operation with his partner Angela in Gippsland. They copped repeated heavy rains over the summer.
From early December through to mid-January, we had three floods, the worst one being December 26th, which wiped out kilometres of fencing, destroyed paddocks that were reserved for fodder production, moved cows from paddock to paddock and out into the adjoining state forest because some of the fences that were destroyed were boundary fences.
Down the road, Wendy Whelan milks 410 dairy cows on about 250 hectares. She bought her farm 2 years ago and says she's now facing tens of thousands of dollars in flood damage bills.
On Boxing Day, I think we had 150 mils in about 8 hours. I've had a lot of my tracks just had the fines taken off them, so they'll have to be resurfaced. And rough estimate have been quoted around the $40,000 to $50,000 mark because we have quite a lot of laneways for the cows to walk on.
Is any of that covered under insurance?
No, apparently you can't insure your tracks. Today I had a call from the Shire just asking what sort of damage I sustained. I did do a flood impact form and sent it to Agriculture Victoria yesterday, but I hadn't heard anything prior to that.
Is there any, as far as you're aware, is there any financial support available to you?
No, I haven't heard of any. And I did contact Danny O'Brien and he looked into it and said there wasn't anything at the moment.
Danny O'Brien is the state member for Gippsland South. He's been pushing the government for recovery funding for farmers.
Yeah, look, it doesn't seem like there's any funding for business or primary producers from the December-January floods, and that's disappointing. It highlights, a failure in the system in that there's a threshold of the number of farmers that need to be impacted by a particular event, and I think that's just quite absurd to say if 30 farmers suffer 50 or 100 grand's damage to their property, they get nothing, but if 3,000 farmers or 300 farmers get the same sort of damage, then suddenly the taxpayer comes in to help. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. It certainly doesn't seem fair. And I think I've actually raised this with the Minister for Emergency Services, seeking for that anomaly to be addressed.
Has any disaster recovery funding been announced for the February 13 storm that went through Merbeu North? Is there any available funding that will benefit agricultural operations?
No, not for farmers or primary producers of any sort. Yes, there are some that might be able to get the prolonged power outage payment, but that's a drop in the ocean compared to the damage that some have sustained.
Is the system fast enough to respond to disasters?
I think there's a fundamental problem here with both state and federal governments that we're just not getting action quick enough. Given the level of disasters that we've had, bushfires, floods, storms in the last 10, 15 years, you would think we'd have the process in much better shape. To have the December, January floods assistance only announced last week towards the end of February just shows how inflexible and slow the bureaucracy is to respond.
Does the disaster assessment and response system need to be overhauled?
Oh, I think so. I think the fact that the criteria is excluding the sort of assistance that I'm talking about for farmers who are affected in a more localised event shows that it's not responsive enough. And look, this is not all about throwing taxpayers' money at people who go through a bad time. People obviously need to be prepared. They need to have insurance where they can. But for many of these events and damage that occurs, particularly to fences, they're just not insurable. And so I think we do need to have an overhaul of the system and also make it a lot more nimble.
The ABC asked the government whether agricultural properties were eligible for the cleanup program. In an email, an Emergency Recovery Victoria spokesperson said, "The recently announced cleanup program will provide eligible residents with access to no-cost property assessments, make safe demolition and removal of hazardous debris where necessary." But they didn't provide specific details about farms. Mr. Stock says he registered with Emergency Recovery Victoria as a flood-affected farmer, but he says after several phone calls and emails, he's none the wiser about what support he's actually eligible for.
It all seemed to be really, really intangible support. There was nothing in the call yesterday or the previous call we had with them last Thursday that actually offered any tangible assistance to us.
Woodside North beef producer Damien Stock ending that report from Fiona Broome in regional Victoria.
ABC Australia Wide.
Getting your kid in to see a specialist is difficult almost everywhere around the country. Whether it's occupational therapy, physiotherapy or speech pathology, plenty of allied health specialists have lengthy wait lists, especially if you're looking for appointments before or after school. And now parents say getting the help their children need is being made even more difficult because some schools have started charging NDIS providers who do appointments at schools. From Queensland's Sunshine Coast, Amy Sheehan has this story.
Sarah Black's son, Zach, used to see a private occupational therapist each fortnight at his Sunshine Coast Primary School after being diagnosed with level 2 autism spectrum disorder. She says that assistance came to an abrupt halt last year.
What we got told at the end of last year by the OT, that was going to be stopping this year because the school was now implementing charges on the room.
Some state school parents have reported fees of up to $50 per therapy visit being charged for the use of school facilities. Sarah said her occupational therapist was told they needed to absorb the fee and not charge it to the National Disability Insurance Scheme.
And that couldn't be forwarded on to the parent through NDIS, which I was more than happy to actually put that bill. That would mean that he could actually still access it at school, but they weren't allowed to do that. My OT was saying that they can't, with that extra cost, they couldn't sustain the fees that they were going to be charged.
She said it was disappointing after hearing other state schools have been more accommodating of NDIS providers.
Some schools were very good at negotiating, but my school wouldn't negotiate.
Sarah says her son needed help with emotional regulation and social skills, specifically in the school environment. Zach is now travelling to therapy appointments after school, which is causing him further fatigue.
I don't think they fully grasp how important occupational therapy is and any other therapy that might come to school. When you're doing therapies like OT, especially with autism, some of the skills that they learn aren't always transferred from one setting to another. They actually need the therapy at school because that's where they're having their issues.
Education Queensland says the use of school facilities under an access agreement was considered by the principal on a case-by-case basis. The department's NDIS provider access policy says principals oversee fees and charges for using school facilities, but the amount is not set and can be discussed by the school with the parent and NDIS provider.
I want you to put your hand in and get a big handful.
Autism education consultant Nell Francis says demand for early intervention therapists is so great that school sessions are often the only way children can access appointments.
The very first appointments that get booked out for any specialist are before school and after school. So it's also, I believe, better to have specialists come into school because the child just loses 45 or 47 minutes of school time and not the commute. Parents are often travelling an hour or hour and a half to appointments.
Education Queensland says it has a range of therapy and other supports for students attending state schools, including occupational therapy, speech-language pathology services and physiotherapy services. Nell says those specialists provide assessments of students, not ongoing therapy.
Those are spread thinly, and so especially in regional Australia, a school might get a visit one semester every couple of years, and that's only for a couple of days. I think there's too few of specialists attached to schools.
Nell says Education Queensland and NDIS providers need to find common ground for the sake of the children and families they support.
All of us are about the child's development and education, just through different pathways, I guess. I think we need to be working together and not see each system as opposition and not see that a child's losing time in the classroom over and above their gaining insight into their development and their gaining skills that will actually increase their ability to age out of school with social skills and communication skills. There's an old saying, it takes a village to raise a child, and that's true.
Autism education consultant Nell Francis sending that report by Amy Sheehan on the Sunshine Coast.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
Let's head to the Pilbara now in Western Australia's north, where there are concerns for the endangered northern quoll. The carnivorous marsupials love living in the region's iconic rocky outcrops, but they're also often sought by mining companies, eager to extract the rich minerals they contain. A recent study has revealed how northern quolls are adapting to life in areas where their habitats have been disturbed by mining. Charlie McLean filed this report.
The northern quoll moves like a bullet, scurrying up a rocky outcrop deep in the Pilbara. These are the areas they love to call home, but in a region flush with iron ore and other critical minerals, these habitats come under threat when mines are opened or extended. PhD candidate Mitchell Cowan from Charles Sturt University wanted to find out more about how quolls living near mine sites are adapting to habitat disruption. In 2021 and 2022, he brought a team out to the Woody Woody manganese mine, around 400 kilometres southeast of Port Hedland. They fitted 9 quolls with movement trackers.
During breeding season, northern quolls, males in particular, travel quite long distances to look for females, and due to this, they require habitats with lots of food and denning opportunities. And what we found was that the quolls, often during breeding season, we're avoiding these mining areas, which are often quite disturbed in terms of they don't have a lot of vegetation. So the food that quolls would be eating, things like native figs, small mammals, invertebrates.
For the quolls they were tracking, this food was hard to come by around Woody Woody, so they had to travel further than normal.
In that case, we found that quolls were preferring the rockier areas, the riparian habitats around creek lines, in order to, you know, gain sustenance during this time that's quite energy costly in terms of their energy uptake.
Using too much energy getting food makes quolls more vulnerable as there's less energy remaining to escape predators like dingoes. When mines are approved, companies are required to do conservation work to offset the mine's environmental impact. Mr. Cowan is hoping his research, which has recently been published, will help improve future offset projects.
What it might mean for future offset projects is, or future conservation projects on mines is retaining of natural habitats in new mines or extensions of mines, and for sites that are potentially already disturbed, you know, maybe doing some kind of rehabilitation, including artificial refuges, which is one thing that's been looked at and continuing to be to be looked at as a potential option for my enclosure plans.
When Mr. Cowan thinks about the future of northern quolls in the Pilbara, it's not actually mining that's most worrying.
Cane toad threat is quite strong, and we're expecting cane toads to eventually reach the Pilbara. And if that was to be the case, then there would be quite a dramatic impact on a lot of native species up there, and quolls would definitely be one.
The invasive pests have had a serious impact on northern quolls in the Kimberley, Northern Territory and Northern Queensland, and they could cross into the Pilbara within 15 years. Mr. Cowan says a definitive method to keep out cane toads hasn't come through, but he's hopeful a breakthrough isn't far off.
We haven't got a 100% solid plan in place, but there's a lot of people working on it.
Charles Sturt University PhD candidate Mitchell Cowan ending that report by the Pilbara's Charlie McLean. You can read more of that story online. Just search ABC Northern Quoll.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
Across the country on the Queensland coast, one man is tackling youth crime through fishing, of all things. After suffering a serious injury, Whitsunday's man Brent Stevenson says fishing pulled him out of a really bad place. Now he hopes it'll do the same for up to 300 at-risk teens. He's working towards turning his passion project, teaching youth to fish, into a fully fledged charity. From Queensland's tropical north, Ashley Bagshaw has this story.
On a balmy Saturday morning, a group of kids and teenagers stand with fishing rods in hand as water laps at the shores of Mackay's picturesque harbour beach. Brent Stevenson, leader of the eager bunch, is guiding them in the skillful art of angling.
You see that smile on a kid's face when they catch a fish, and it's priceless for me, it's priceless for the parents watching, it's priceless for that kid.
Over the past 3 years, the former pool repairman has dedicated hundreds of hours to teaching youth how to fish. He has a passion for working with at-risk young people, but also opens the sessions up to other kids keen to connect with like-minded peers.
It's a conversation starter, whether you're young or old, and that was the basis of it, and that's when I also realised there was so much more to what I was doing, being a role model to these kids.
Mr. Stevenson's journey to becoming a fishing teacher started in 2019, when a serious back injury from a workplace incident left him in what he describes as a really bad place. Then, a back specialist in Brisbane dropped the bombshell that he'd be living with the injury for the rest of his life. Forced to start over, Mr. Stevenson moved to the tourist town of Airlie Beach in the Whitsundays, where he reconnected with his love of fishing.
I was recovering from a serious back injury and just needed a fresh start. And I take myself fishing every day, and then just had a moment one day where I realised how lucky I was to have been introduced to fishing and how fishing essentially pulled me out of a pretty bad place in my life at that time.
As fishing helped him to overcome a daily struggle of chronic pain and adjust to the reality of having a bad back permanently, he wondered what impact it might have on teens facing their own struggles.
So I started volunteering at one of the local youth places in Airlie Beach. So you're looking at disadvantaged youth, at-risk youth, kids who might not fit in places or even just looking for somewhere else to hang out.
The professional fishing teacher launched Combos for Kids, an initiative to rehome secondhand fishing gear, and also started running free fishing workshops. He's now taught more than 60 kids and families in the Mackay and Whitsunday regions how to fish, and rehomed more than 90 new and used fishing rods, reels and kits. To date, Mr. Stevenson's work has been a passion project, but this year he is hoping to help up to 300 kids and is looking to partner up with the charity and introduce sponsorships.
Once we get this the charity side of it set up, we'll then be able to open up business sponsorships, and you can actually be able to sponsor a child or a fishing clinic, whether you're just a mum and dad at home and you like what we're doing.
He believes fishing has a range of benefits and could even help curb youth crime rates.
It's a personal level, but then it's also on a greater, it's a social level, and then it also benefits the community in return. So we see an impact on youth crime, social, physical, mental exercise. It covers all bases, and that flows all the way through to the economy and on and on and on.
Youth crime remains a prevalent issue in Queensland, with young people aged between 10 and 17 committing more offences than the rest of the population. Criminology expert Dr. Renee Zarno from the University of Queensland says repeat offending remains one of the biggest issues.
So what we've seen recently is a small group of offenders are chronically offending and the severity of their offences appears to be quite bad.
So the question is, can phishing actually help prevent youth crime? Well, according to Dr. Zarno, it could definitely play a role.
As basic as it sounds, sports and recreation programs actually have one of the most consistently positive findings in terms of their effect to prevent crime and reduce reoffending.
Kids involved in the free phishing clinics, like Nate Bloy, who isn't himself an at-risk teen, says he's still definitely seeing the benefits of phishing alongside other young people.
It's a good way to get out of the house, hang with your friends and also meet a few along the way. It's definitely the way. If you're having a bad day, it's actually scientifically proven that phishing actually helps with your mental health and calms you down.
He says he's also seen a difference in his fellow anglers.
Few people have come back to me and said that it's definitely helped them. Get them out of the house, keep them out of trouble and, yeah, just have fun as well.
13-year-old fisherman Nate Bloy ending that story from Ashley Bagshaw on the Queensland coast.
ABC Australia Wide.
Soccer is a universally loved sport. For seasonal workers employed on berry farms in Tasmania, it's more than just a game. This summer, they've been playing for bragging rights against rival farms in a friendly soccer competition, and it's helping them find their feet in a foreign country. From Launceston, Larissa Smith has the story.
It's a real party vibe at this soccer pitch in the middle of Launceston. This is no ordinary game, though. The players are all from Timor-Leste and they pick fruit for opposing berry farms.
We're all friendly, but we all, you know, even at a growing level, we want to grow the most berries per hectare or yield or have the fastest pickers. So there's that rivalry and now it's stemmed out to a soccer rivalry. So
Simon Dornorf is the farm manager at Hillwood Berries. He was approached by his pickers to set up some friendly games against other berry farms in the area. So teams were selected, training began and uniforms were ordered.
Can't take credit for that. That was the guy's idea. They said, oh, we want a Mountford Berries shirt. We want to be part of the Mountford Berries team.
Gemma McKinnon manages the seasonal worker program at Mountford Berries.
My father-in-law said, oh, if we were in England, we'd be very rich, wouldn't we? We've got a soccer team after us. It's something that they talk about. And now that we've played a few games against some of the other farms, it's, oh, we won against this farm and we've lost against this farm, so we've got to play them again to try and beat them. And it's a talk around the farm while they're there.
For the fruit pickers who have grown up playing soccer back home, these friendly games have helped them feel like they belong here.
I'm Antonio Pinto. My colleague is Atoy. I've been working for Hillwood Berries in Tasmania for 7 years. Soccer is one of the most popular sports in Timor. Last year, we did a soccer with the local people. I can say it's like we like socialize with the people in around us, like community, yeah. Part of the community, so that's one of the positive things that we gain during our stay in Australia.
My name is Fernando Nunes da Costa Barreto. They call me Nunes.
I play for Hillwood Berries.
I was amazing today. We hope we keep going doing this activity for the future to make us like feel not only for work, but we also have fun, you know. Yeah.
The pastoral care side of thing is more about their welfare while they're here, so taking them to doctor's appointments and making sure that they're looked after in terms of their finances and the food that they're eating and making sure that they're healthy and well. So these extra things is not necessarily prescribed that we have to, but we feel that it just brings that extra morale into the group. They enjoy their time here in Australia while they're here, and that's sort of our aim, is that we want them to be here, we want them to earn money, and we want them to really enjoy being here while they're working and earning money for their family.
The crowds have been amazing, and I can just see the smiles on the faces of the players, that they've just had a thoroughly great time.
Yeah, they did. I think there was a winner. I think Mountford won that one. We're sort of friends with the other farms, you know, the bosses at the other farms, so it'll be good bragging rights that our team has won this one, so that's good.
Viva Tiberlaste!
Some of Australia's finest Timor-Leste soccer players, ending that report from Larissa Smith. And that's Australia Wide for this Monday. I'm Michelle Stanley. I'll catch you next time.
ABC Listen.